Morning, everyone. Before we get started, can we just officially have each party make their appearances for the record?
Yes, James Tavit, Deputy Public Defender for Mr. Darnell Griffin.
All right. Mr. Tavit, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. Please do so.
Mr. Griffin and I appreciate this opportunity to discuss the issues that we raised on our brief. In particular, I guess the issue that this court seems most interested in on the issue of the grand jury counsel and its remarks. Now, I guess the first step that needs to be done is to determine the appropriate standard to governing this dismissal of indictments involving grand jury counsel. Because in this jurisdiction, I guess there's a standard for motion to dismiss indictments for lack of probable cause, motion to dismiss indictments for prosecutorial misconduct. And there really is no standard set forth here. I do note there was one case that I found last night, State v. Cardis, and I know I didn't, it's not included in my brief. I emailed it to Mr. Fudo, but basically didn't get it. I just informed him just 15 minutes ago of this case, or 20 minutes ago. It's an ICA case, basically, and the issue was whether the grand jury's counsel's advice was accurate or misleading. And the case was basically about, well, the defendant was an ACO, or adult corrections officer, who was charged with sexually assaulting a prisoner. And then I guess one of the grand jury counsel, the grand jury asked whether consent was a defense or not, and grand jury counsel read the statute. The defense argued or appealed the issues that the advice was wrong or misleading. The ICA never really reached a standard because I guess initially they just said counsel was correct in the law because, you know, there's no effective consent on an ACO inmate. So, but what I take out of that case is that in the holding, it basically said because consent is not a defense, grand jury's counsel advice to grand jury was not prejudicial and misleading. So I think whatever standard that we may have has to incorporate some of that language in there already. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do. I think the cases that are more relevant, though, are the prosecutor misconduct cases. I mean, it starts with all the way from State v. Joao, State v. Pulava, State v. Mendonca, and this ICA case, State v. Chong, which the prosecutor cites in his brief. Chong is really good. It's because it actually gives a good history overview or summary of how the law has developed in that area. And each
Before you get into the prosecutorial misconduct cases, well, what's your view of what the role of the grand jury counsel is?
Well,
in other words, is a grand jury counsel an agent of the prosecution? Is it an agent of the defendant? Is it in other words, if you're going to analogize it to a prosecutor, it doesn't seem to me that really fits the role of. I mean, the grand jury counsel is independent of the prosecution.
Right. And actually, in the transcripts, they actually refer to it as not grand jury counsel, but independent counsel. And it is, I guess, appointed by the court. And I know it's tough to blame the prosecutor we're not blaming the prosecutor in this case. But in cases where the defendant's rights are infringed, his due process rights, it really doesn't matter. I mean, convictions get reversed, even though it's not the prosecutor's fault.
Right.
I'm trying to
figure out we're all struggling what the right model for this case is.
I think it
seems that in situations that the function of the grand jury, I guess at its core, is to ensure that there's probable cause for the crime before someone is required to face those charges. But in this case, the defendant went through trial and was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
Now, when there's prosecutorial misconduct in the grand jury situation, there's due process concerns about prosecutorial overreaching.
Right.
And so you want to make sure that the procedure is correct. And that's why, even though the defendant is convicted on a higher standard after trial, you might vacate the conviction.
Right. There is no.
But here it seems like an odd situation because we have grand jury counsel who is apparently the one who's accused of wrongdoing.
Right.
How does that fit in? There's no deterring the prosecution rationale for making the state start all over again. What's the rationale for making the state start all over again when the defendant was convicted based on a higher standard?
In a case like this, it's And like I say, I don't want to blame the prosecutor because they didn't cause this. But once they realized that this was done, and then obviously the defendant was prejudiced by these remarks, and we'll get into the, you know, debate that issue hopefully a little later, they should have chose to re-indict this person without all those comments. I think the court's focusing on it's because it's independent, why blame them? But I think it's still the same similar standard for prosecutor misconduct. I mean, if it was ineffective counsel on a trial, we still apply a high standard that all parties in the system, and even if the grand jurors themselves create misconduct.
Right, so why don't we apply the ineffective assistance of counsel standard as opposed to the prosecutorial misconduct standard?
Well, we know that it's not. I mean, if the court wishes to, I guess it can, but I think it's more in line with the, like in State v. Cardis, they didn't really, you know, they addressed it where there was misleading or prejudice, and that was the key in that respect. So it's, and in this cases that basically, like in the Arizona case that I cited, it, I mean, that was a county attorney, kind of a hybrid in that respect. So I know it's a little different, but it's still more, even though it's independent, the prosecutor had the opportunity to re-indict this matter. And then the court, I think the lower court, you know, erred, or I guess the standards abused discretion in denying the motion at this point.
So assuming you're right that there's some misconduct prejudice requirement, what's the prejudice, or what's the harm in this case in terms of the conduct of the grand jury counsel?
I guess I was going to concede at this point that the standard that we use is the prosecutor misconduct standard. That's a pretty tough standard because it's pretty much, you know, if the indictment's valid on its face, the burden is on us, the defense. And the standard there is the misconduct or the comments or whatever it is, it has to be so extreme and flagrant that causes a jury to overreach or to be deceived or invades the province of the jury. I mean, all these cases, they use those words, but if the conduct is extreme and flagrant. Here, I'm going to focus basically on two of the comments. One, in particular, is the sex offender registry. Now, when grand jury counsel brings this up on his own, that there's a sex offender, there's a sex offender database or there's a sex offender registry, it insinuates Mr. Griffin is a sex offender and is required to register. Now, first of all, we know the evidence, such comments are clear and proper. I think the trial court recognized that. It's in its written findings and oral findings. The trial prosecutor actually even concedes in argument in his at the hearing that the remarks were improper. So,
but was there? Didn't the counsel then come back and say, "Well, I don't know whether that's true or not."
Well, I know, but regardless, they throw it in there, so there's a possibility that he is a sex offender or not. And actually, what makes this takes it to the improper, to the extreme, and flagrant is that Mr. Griffin was never convicted of a sex assault before this crime, sex offense crime, nor was he ever required to register as a sex offender. I mean, it's just this conjecture. We throw out grand jury counsel. You know, I know they're assigned, and so they probably see him over the course of months, but there's some authority there. And there's a suggestion, and more than a suggestion.
But was it clear from the record that, in fact, the statement about the sex offender registry was really conjecture? It was obvious that it was conjecture on the grand jury counsel's part. In other words, it seemed from the transcript that he really had no clue as to anything about the specific details of this case, and he was just, and I think a few times he said, I don't know if that's right, or I don't know what I'm talking about, but maybe. Does that context affect the analysis?
Okay, you know what, if he actually said, he is a sex offender and he hasn't registered. Obviously, I mean, it's an open shun case, we're done. Here, it's still the fact that it's out there, and it's out there, it wasn't even prompted. I mean, it wasn't even a question, was he a sex, you know, it was just out there. You know, it's like a statement, an opinion, if this court wants to to clarify, you know, wants to label it at that or conjecture. I think it was more than a conjecture. I mean, I think there's a law that requires, I mean, he's talking about there's a law that requires sex offenders, so therefore there's some type of database. So that's probably, how, you know, I mean, that's how the flow is. Mr. Griffin must be on this, you know, why did they bring him up? Because he must have been in this database, because I know sex offenders got to register. You know, I'm not sure, but you could, you know, it's almost, that's what I think, and you may want to consider that or not. That's up to you. You know, that's, I mean, that's, unfortunately, when counsel was, you know, was talking, I guess to say, or trying to be helpful, he just gave way too much information, and that information was false. I mean, it was just wrong. I mean, it's now, and I know.
But the grand jury wasn't really, you're saying it's unsolicited information, so the grand jury wasn't asking him, hey, tell us about this
No,
case.
See, so that's what.
So does that make a difference? Because the grand jurors.
No, well, it wouldn't have, it really wouldn't have made a difference. In the big picture, no, because if grand jury asked that, the proper response would have been that is not for your consideration or something to that effect. You know, that's not for your consideration in deciding whether to return a bill or not. But here, actually, I guess I could say either way it could be worse or not, you know, or not worse, I guess, in this respect. It's just he brings it up. And that's kind of like we're focusing on grand jury counsel's conduct.
Counsel, Mr. Tabby, if I can ask you, when you talked about the standard, the extreme flagrant conduct, what about the burden with regards to showing prejudice? I mean, that's really, you know, form versus substance, and to some degree. I mean, there's no one that's suggesting this was wonderful conduct on the part of the grand jury counsel. But what with regards to prejudice, where does that burden lie?
Okay, well, the burden of prejudice, obviously the burden lies on us.
And here, I guess what I'm struggling with is that in the lower court, didn't the defense basically concede that there was sufficient evidence, irregardless of these comments?
And I know that, and I'm gonna be bound by that. I mean, I think the trial deputy conceded that there was sufficient evidence presented. But I know the standard, like set forth in Chong, the standard is basically if the indictment is valid on its face. So that's like the preliminary question. Then we go into the extreme flagrant and prejudice and the analysis. So we're already over there at this point. I know the counsel conceded, but the prejudice here is if we look at the evidence that was presented, okay, I mean, it's a pretty close call. I mean, we have a person who had sex with her that weekend, a person that just matches the description, and the vehicle was close, similar.
So you think it's like a harmless error test? The weaker the evidence, the less flagrant alleged misconduct has to be to take you over the top.
There's other comments that I think maybe may take us over the top here, but I think we need to consider that because there's no actual evidence that he caused her death. There's evidence that he had sex with her, and then if we want to take it light most favorable to the state, he had sex with her that night. I mean, there's no physical evidence, no testimonial evidence, no. I know there's DNA evidence of sex, but there's no DNA evidence of assault. I mean, of murder, causing death. So, the facts in this case, I could easily see the jury or grand jury just saying, no, not enough. You know, and then at this point, and obviously they were wondering. Why is this guy a suspect all of a sudden? You know, I mean there's, I don't know how many grand jurors were in this room, but we know one or two are wondering, why is he a suspect now in 1997 when this thing happened in the early 90s? The other comment that was egregious or extreme and flagrant is just the fact that there's this mention of a DNA database. Now, there's no reason for the grand jury to know that he became a suspect because there was a match from the decedent's DNA onto the database. I mean, The database
that was
basically
a witness's testimony, right?
Excuse me?
That was a witness's testimony.
Well, that was a witness after the whole fiasco with grand jury counsel and the grand jurors, because he brings up this database, this DNA, and basically pages and pages of reading this, can I ask that? The counsel basically says, go ahead and ask that. But that was after, and that's where I indicate where maybe the prejudice lies as well, is that they start asking that question. So they considered the DNA database. And DNA database is just as bad. Well, it's close to as bad as the sex offender, because the sex offender, he never got convicted of crime. A DNA database means you did something wrong. And you, because basically, I know my DNA, it's not in a database. I know Mr. Fudo's DNA is not in a database. I'm pretty sure your guy's DNA is not in a database. It's basically database, DNA, felons.
All right.
Okay, so basically, we have these felons, so we now know he's a criminal, he's a felon. And the prejudice here, and I know we can look at the evidence, but here we have the grand jury following up on this matter. And though the purpose of the statement was to find out whether he was a suspect or not, but the collateral damage here is database, because none of the grand jury's DNA is in the database. How can it get in there? It got in there because he must have done something wrong before.
All right, can you address the other issue, which is its sufficiency of the evidence?
Yes, and basically that's the issue where if I could just skip to this part right here. Okay, basically, I think in the state's answering brief, they point to like four factors. One, that there's sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Griffin. Basically, the two witnesses, Caldera and Henson, observed Evan leave the nightclub with a male matching Griffin's general description, and that it was the same type of vehicle. Well, number one, and I know it was years later, they were shown a picture of Griffin. They couldn't even ID him in court. He's just a general description at this point. There's no actual ID whether he left with Evelyn that night. Now, the car, and this is the key thing I think counsel below is trying to focus, in my reply brief and opening brief in the argument section, I indicated Griffin's Pathfinder didn't have a spare tire. It did have a spare tire. And the Pathfinder that left that night, and I'll just refer to it as Evelyn's Pathfinder just for ease here, didn't have a spare tire mounted on the back.
Did not.
So,
okay, so just getting clear, the witness testimony is at the car that the victim left in.
Evelyn's Pathfinder did not have
no spare tire,
but it had a tow hitch. Now, okay, tow hitch. And I know thousands of people attended that night, and maybe hundreds of cars parked there, but this witness says, she specifically remembered, because these are professional valet drivers, and I know we use valet a lot, and I can't see them banging cars around too much. He banged this car against the wall as he was reversing, and he was surprised that he did, because he thought he had clearance. So he actually went around, checked it, because, oh man, tow hitch.
Is there any evidence as to whether this spare tire and or the tow hitch is something that can be
taken off? I know we've asked, they asked, in this testimony, it's so long ago that they asked the state's witness, did you check with the insurance company whether there was a tow hitch or not? Apparently, when Detective Sunia, I guess, went over to Maui to check the vehicle, and there was no indication of a tow hitch, or there's no tow hitch. I don't think it was elaborated. So that's one. The color, obviously, black and dark green. I'll give that one.
So the record is basically unclear to whether or not.
I don't think it's unclear. The state didn't prove that there was that there was a tow hitch. And I think it'd be obvious I'm sure if there was one and one was taken off because you have holes drilled in there or something to, it would have been obvious. And that surely, I'm sure the state would have pointed out if there was one. So I don't want to say the record's unclear. I don't think they met its burden, and I think we could pretty much safe to assume if there was any indication a tow hitch did exist, it would have been brought out.
And the car that they examined subsequently that had been sold, this one has a spare tire attached to it.
Right. So that, the color, black, green, dark gray, nighttime, you know, I'll give them that. You know, I'm not too much worried on that part. The third thing is, they mentioned Salt Lake Boulevard because that's where Griffin lived, Mr. Griffin lived, and the body was, or not body, because she was, Miss Luca was found at Kauka Boulevard, and I didn't think, it sounded like it's close. It's not close. You know, I live in Mililani, so it's quite far from Salt Lake to Kauka Boulevard. So, I mean, it's not a matter of convenience, I was dropped off there. The other issue is the pants, and that was a big deal made of the pants. Mr. Griffin's wife was pregnant and was wearing size 10 pants. Ms. Luca was found wearing size 10 pants. And that wasn't her pants, obviously, because it was too big on her. Problem is that Ms. Luca is 6 inches taller than Griffin's wife. So the pants, and I know it wasn't really stress, but that's a big difference in this case here, 6 inches. So it's not like it was a... So the evidence that they do have is the DNA. And the DNA, basically, the expert says, I think he said 48 hours, and I might be mistaken, but it's the weekend. Mr. Griffin could have had relations with her Saturday, because she was there Saturday, or could have had it happen Sunday night. And
does the record indicate when the sample was taken?
The sample was taken... I think the rape kit or the sex assault kit, I think it's called, was taken when they found the body at, I apologize here. When they found Ms. Luca on the freeway at about in the morning, and I think when they took her to the hospital, that's when they conducted the.
Right, I thought it was on the 7th, but I didn't see from either brief a time on the 7th.
Oh, time. It happened that morning because I think that's what they wanted to do right away because for whatever reason. And I know it was a, because it wasn't at Kapi'olani, the SATC, the Sex Offender Treatment Center. It was kind of a rush job. I know they had done it that morning. So it could have been some other time. But I'm going to give the state, let's assume the light most favorable to the state. I mean, that's the standard here. So light most favorable to the state, sex occurred Sunday night, all right? And let's say, let's ignore the Pathfinder evidence, okay? And sex occurred Sunday night. I don't want to say he's guilty. The only thing that proves, he had sex with her. There's no evidence of, let's say, sperm cells or DNA struggle of his DNA, nothing, because we know she got choked or strangled. There's nothing to indicate he was the one. What they have is he was the last man, assuming that we ignore the Pathfinder evidence. He was the last man seen with Evelyn Luca, and that's it. Now, that's enough to make him suspicious, a person of interest. Not enough here, and I know it's a difficult case because I think Mr. Takata, who did a wonderful job in this case here, but it's just not enough here. I mean, it just doesn't add up here. And I went 3 minutes over my time here, so I'd like to reserve my last 7 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. Is there a particular place you want to start?
We'll let you start and then we'll stop you if we want to.
Then if that's the case, I don't really think there's an issue here with respect to the standard. I think we've had cases recently, State versus Montgomery, that dealt with the mootness and also dealt with the conduct of grand jury counsel. We have an analytical structure through precedent in this jurisdiction dealing with defects in the environment, defects in the finding of probable cause. It's here, it's in place, 2099, the ICA used it in Brooks. They have
right, but is this case a defect in probable cause? No, they're not arguing that the indictment is defective because there was insufficient evidence of probable cause. They're arguing that the grand jury, because of the independent counsel, considered extraneous matters that were prejudicial to the defendant in rendering the indictment. So,
which affected the finding of probable cause. And even if it did,
I think it's a different. I don't think it's a sufficiency argument. It's a misconduct argument. My question is, how do you analyze it since the misconduct is not necessarily attributable to the prosecutor, but attributable to an agent of the grand jury, just not part of the prosecution team.
I agree with that, and I think for that reason, and in light of the fact that Article 1, Section 11 wasn't created with respect to the grand jury counsel to confer a substantive right on defendant, what you should look at, or what we can look at again, is the analytical precedent in this jurisdiction that has to do with, one, concessions of counsel, which he agreed that his counsel did say there was sufficient probable cause, and then also on the appellate standard, the consequence or implication of not challenging any findings of fact, some of which were, and I think the court should be specifically made aware of these. These statements and responses from a grand jury counsel, while improper, did not prejudice the grand jury proceedings. Conduct of independent counsel did not invade the province of the grand jury and did not tend to induce action other than the grand jurors in their uninfluenced judgment deemed warranted on the evidence and was fairly presented before them. 8, there was sufficient legal and competent evidence presented to the grand jury to establish probable cause to indict the defendant for murder. Conclusion of law 2, which is supported by the unchallenged findings of fact, which should bind this court of appeal under Raposa. In this case, defendant has failed to establish that the words and conduct of the independent counsel prejudiced the grand jury proceedings. Conclusion of law 3, the grand jury acted upon legal and competent evidence when it found probable cause to indict the defendant for murder. My concern with this case is that there are cases that have dealt with the conduct of grand jury counsel as they affect the return of the true bill. The standard shouldn't change, and in the most respectful way I think I can put it to this court, in as much as any rule could involve the separation of powers, I think precedent says we should tread a little lightly. Provision for grand jury counsel was amended to the Constitution, so it's not with the executive branch. The enabling legislation, which provided actually for the grand jury counsel and instructs what his responsibilities and duties are, was also enacted by the legislation. And I think equally significant is the fact that it lies with the Chief Justice to control, appoint, and excuse a grand jury counsel. Then I think you also have the overlay of the administrative judge who issues at the commencement of a new grand jury counsel and grand juror impanelment separate packets for both of them, which make very clear what their duties are and what their duties are not. So to me, there's just so much involved.
Isn't it clear that the grand jury counsel was acting improperly? I mean, his function is to advise the grand jurors as to what the applicable law is, not to speculate on what may or may not happen in the case when it's clear he's got no basis for speculating or knowledge about what the government's investigation involved.
And I do agree with that proposition, but what I want to be clear to is on this record, people have loosely talked about what the grand jury counsel did as being improper, but I think when you critically look at what wasn't said, really, all he was doing was having almost a stream of consciousness flow that imparted no information and no specific indication of the strength of the case. On at least 5 separate occasions, he said he didn't know if the guy was a suspect. He said he didn't know what the police had against him. It doesn't sound for me like they had enough to accuse him of anything. With respect to the database, he specifically said, I don't know if defendant is in a sex offender database. And a grand jury specifically said, We don't know he has because there's been no evidence of that.
Right, but that's a prejudice argument, though, right? But the first issue is what standard do we analyze his conduct under? In other words, would you concede that there could be some things the independent counsel, grand jury counsel says that would render an indictment defective? He gets in there and says, I know this guy. He's a bad guy. Yeah, you know, I was his neighbor. He used to beat up his wife or whatever.
I'd say that.
I mean, we would definitely in that situation say that's no good.
You would say that.
Right. So you're not saying that the independent counsel sort of has immunity to do anything.
No, that would be ridiculous.
The question is, well, what test should we apply in analyzing whether his conduct was improper or proper?
Well, you know, that's a complicated question because it depends on when it's brought. If it's brought pretrial motion to dismiss indictment for what you said, there's going to be the standard which counsel admits he must show there's prejudice. It's got to be clear and convincing evidence of prejudice, not speculation, not innuendos, not intimations, all right? And then let's say that after that motion to dismiss the indictment is denied and it goes through trial, well, precedent says then that finding with respect to probable cause, now that problem now is rendered moot. Justice Acoba in In Re Doe, he recognized even that it wouldn't result in necessarily the vacation of a conviction. It should be looked at to see whether there was harmless error as it impacted the conviction. Well, we all know, and I don't think no one's going to contend here, that what is said at the grand jury is somehow imparted to the jury as a trial such that there could be some infecting problem that carried on from there to the trial to be able to find, yes, that contaminated the truth-seeking function of the judicial process. That just doesn't occur. Moreover, as the structure is now set up in this jurisdiction, as in the case of Rodriguez, had counsel honestly thought after he brought that motion to dismiss, and in light of the concessions he made, that there was sufficient common evidence, he had a vehicle to seek immediate appellate relief, interlocutory appeal, which they did in Rodriguez. Now see, that wasn't done in this case. So that's another overlay if you're thinking about a problem that needs addressing, a system that's broke, that needs fixing. I would think I would avail myself of that interlocutory relief, at least then I could say on appeal, yes, I tried. Not no, I went through trial. Nothing was brought in from the grand jury. I'm not going to challenge any findings of fact, but I want this court to believe that somehow the conviction should be vacated. No, I don't agree with that.
All right. Can you address the sufficiency of the evidence at trial?
What I think was conspicuously absent from counsel's recitation of what the state relied on was his failure to mention, even in passing, Nancy Griffin. In my opinion, he gets to where he's saying, yeah, this guy is a real guy of interest, without mentioning his wife. Because I think when you mention the wife, no, he vaults then from man of interest to murderer that should be convicted. This is a lady that in March 28th.
Let me stop you and ask you a question first. If all the evidence was that this is a defendant was a person who had sex with the victim prior to her being found dead, would that be enough to convict the defendant?
In the abstract, it depends on how soon. If it was 10 years ago, no, obviously not.
Well,
if it was
okay, let me ask it another way. If all you got is the DNA evidence in this case, is that enough to convict the defendant?
Just so I understand parameters of the question, you have DNA evidence that showed Darnell Griffin had sex with this woman, and the woman is dead.
The DNA evidence in the case. Victim's found, DNA is found from her. There's some question about how long the DNA would last, the unmotile sperm would last in her, and that's all you got.
Well, but you also want, I can also include the circumstances of how she was found, correct?
Right, okay.
I'm going to say yes.
Because?
Because one, she didn't have panties on. Two, she was strangled. Three, she had bruises about her body. Four, I think any sentient, reasonable person could think, let me think, why would someone take the panties? Panties might have DNA. DNA might connect me to the dead girl. I've got to take those panties. I think that's like a no-brainer. It would have been a more difficult case for Mr. Takata, but as you heard counsel, he did very well with the difficult case because he didn't just rely on that evidence. He saw the significance of Nancy Griffin's testimony, her ability to, remarkable ability to remember 7 years after the fact. You know, we were sitting at home in 1999, and a Crime Stoppers bulletin came on, and wow, when they said it was a Green Pathfinder, he looked relieved. Now, to say that's an ordinary response for nobody involved with the murder of a person would be an understatement. If it was his daughter or some connection to it, understandable, relief. But that response is not understandable, and her ability to remember it 7 years later when she's speaking to the detective, that's kind of curious. This is a murder investigation which she's being asked about by Detective Sunia. She says at that time, she told the lady the truth. At that time, no, defendant, I don't know where he was at. Also, a year before that, she also remembers, very peculiar reaction he had when he was requested to give DNA. He's outraged. He was very disgruntled, if you say. So then we get to this point of this statement, and you're kind of starting to think as a juror, is she knowing something that she's not telling us? Has somebody seeking her aid possibly to help in disjoining them from the crime? Well, of course she is. And then we get the call from him the day after her interview with the detective. He's arrested. A lot of things you can do when you make your free phone call. Not likely you're going to be telling your wife, clean that car. You might be saying,
What's the significance of that? It's not even the same car.
Well, the significance says that psychological profiling, it's not uncommon for murderers, especially serial killers, to keep trophies and souvenirs from their victim. Jeffrey Dahmer.
Is there evidence of that in the case?
Is there? No. The evidence that was germane to the case in the totality.
Right. So in the context of this case, why is the defendant, after he's arrested, calling his wife to say clean a car that everyone agrees could have no relationship to any alleged murder? What's the significance of just calling and saying clean the car?
Okay, I need to correct this on the record. Everyone's not saying that. He's saying that.
Well, you agree it's a different car.
I agree that you can have a newspaper clipping in a glove compartment. I agree you can have panties in the trunk. I agree you can have trophies of the victim, like murderers do, in that car. And I agree that would be the place to put them. And I also agree that if I was Darnell Griffin worried about DNA connecting me, sure as heck, if I knew her panties were in that car because that's where I had stored them, get those things out of the car. That's what you'd be saying. But bottom line, and I think overarching this is
that— How did the state argue that?
Not improperly, if you look at the brief.
What's the state's argument as to why that statement is relevant to the case?
I don't know that the state actually, as you're characterizing it, argued it in that sense. They did not argue it inappropriately. And they just mentioned the fact that the panties were missing. They didn't really argue something beyond that it was very peculiar in this situation to be telling your wife to clean the car with urgency. And I think what the state did astutely do is not trying to build this wall of beyond reasonable doubt by asking the jurors, I want you to look at this one brick in isolation, of this one brick in isolation, of this one brick. The prosecutor put it all together and gave the 12 reasonable jurors more than sufficient evidence to find beyond a reasonable doubt he murdered him. There's no contention in the brief that any evidence was argued improper or that the prosecutor engaged in any misconduct. So I think if you're asking me, walking down the street without anything else, clean the car, who knows? But I think if you ask a person, would you think that's what you would be saying if you were arrested as opposed to get bail money, call my lawyer? Does that strike you as slightly suspicious? And if it does, let me add this other
bit of fact that she changed her alibi at the time of trial, and 2 days before speaking to the prosecutor, she had spoken to her defendant husband and his counsel, and now it went from, I don't know where he was that Sunday, to he was definitely home that Sunday. Now, as she was the only person that provided defendant with the physical alibi, as the trial court found in its uncontested findings of fact, the jury had a right to question Nancy Griffin. If he's an adulterer, that's one thing, but cops don't investigate adultery. And in light of her spectacular memory of things having to do with his peculiar responses dealing with this investigation from 8 years before, to all of a sudden now have this historic clarity that, no, he was here, so that means he couldn't have killed her.
Now, help me analyze the evidence, in the light most favorable to the state, the evidence regarding a person who matched the physical description of the defendant getting into the car at the nightclub after midnight that evening, with the fact that the evidence indicates that the car that the valet recalls driving up is not the defendant's car. How do you analyze all that evidence? In other words, the witnesses identified the car as having a tow trailer and not having a spare tire attached to the back, whereas subsequently the defendant's car was found and it did not have a tow trailer and it did have a tire on the back. How does that play out? In other words, does that help the case for the state? Is that negative for the state? What's your analysis of how that evidence plays out?
I believe analytically it plays out somewhere along these lines. The jurors were instructed that they determine the credibility of the witnesses. They can determine which parts of the witnesses' testimony is true or not true. Unlike Nancy Griffin, the witnesses with respect to the tow hitch, they did not change their testimony, and they were subject to the human frailties of memory mistake. Simply put, jurors dismiss it as not a consequential fact. The SUV to which you're referring was found years later. But
the tow trailer testimony was what the valet said right after he was questioned, right?
Exactly. And he didn't
flip-flop. There's no lack of memory on that.
Or said frailties, okay, of the human mind. Okay, so he, as the deputy
was
said,
was there any indication that other than misrecollection, that the witness had any motive bias either way in terms of his recollection?
Motive or bias to?
To lie.
For the defendant or against the defendant?
Either way.
No, I would say no.
All right, so you attribute his claim that there was a tow trailer there to misrecollection?
Let's make it simpler. He was mistaken. It's no earth-shattering event. He parks hundreds of cars. He was simply mistaken. But I don't think that was, and the record will bear me out on this, that wasn't the critical evidence upon which the state relied that satisfied the jury that beyond reasonable doubt, Darnell Griffin murdered this individual. That wasn't a linchpin. And there were enough other evidence where the jury could hear that, put it in the context, which they rightfully should, of all the other evidence and not just separate it out and look at it. It was in the context of everything.
But the function of that evidence was to place the defendant as the last person with the victim when she was seen alive. Seen uninjured.
I would agree that some people might say that, but I think the more salient evidence for the jury was his sperm in the woman and the way she was found and the fact that she was redressed and Nancy Griffin's attempt to alibi for him. I think that overshadowed everything and became the aha moment at the trial.
Well, counsel, given that, if that is the aha evidence in this case, why shouldn't the defense have had the opportunity to submit evidence with regards to the sexual activity of the victim here? That, I mean, the key thing they're pointing to with regards to that is there are potentially, or they were precluded from providing evidence that there were potentially a number of other individuals who also could have been involved with the victim.
Respectfully, and that's not a fair characterization of what they were contending. What they were actually contending is that this unidentified group of people that like to party and have casual sex she was among them. Because she's among that group, maybe someone in that group of casual sex hookups at parties could have murdered her without identifying a single individual specifically. Therefore, this precedent, State versus Robalisa, State versus Fukusaku, South Carolina versus Holmes, which is a United States Supreme Court case, which recognizes third-party evidence, unless it's shown to be motive and opportunity of a specific person, is collateral and irrelevant.
Were there not specific other individuals who were identified as potential suspects in this case?
There were.
And to what extent was there evidence presented at the trial with regards to them?
The judge allowed him to present that evidence in light of a faulty police investigation. That was brought out. The detective witnesses gave their reasons for investigating the persons and then concluding those investigations. What those persons were is hooked up to this general group of partiers. If you look at the two-day hearings on that that question that you said, not once did defense counsel identify anybody. He's made specifically clear, no, it's her lifestyle. It's her lifestyle. It exposes her to harm. So you go to a club, you hook up, and then you sleep with someone. Okay, those are the kind of people that murder people. There's not even a factual basis for which the mind can wrap around that concept, that people that have casual sex at a party, there's more likely to be murders among them?
There were certainly more than that. I mean, there was evidence of another individual who had a pathfinder of somewhat similar color within the range of the witness testimony, the valet witness testimony. I mean, so in that respect, it's not just a generalized group of partiers. It's a particular individual, for instance, who had a similar pathfinder.
That evidence was allowed to be brought out. That evidence was not what defense counsel was seeking to bring out and was precluded with regard to this casual sex encounters. There's quite a distinction there, Your Honor. The evidence to which you just said and the evidence that there were these other black individuals, that was brought out. The evidence that was not allowed to bring out is counsel, I'm not going to let you just argue that because she seems to be promiscuous, that therefore anybody with whom she could have been promiscuous with, who I have no idea and I'm not telling this court, I'm going to let you bring that out too. No, Robalisa says clearly that's not fair. Fukusaku says no. The United States Supreme Court has confirmed that as being a valid exercise on the trial court's mode to ascertain the truth and not letting issues collateral to the main just confuse the juror. 24 other states in the District of Columbia have all recognized that, and the Ninth Circuit and People versus Territory of Guam versus Ignacio. So that's like a bedrock kind of thing. If you want to make it relevant, specific person, identify their motive and their opportunity. Then have at it, bring it in. But just everybody in here was in the courtroom, so somebody could have killed someone? No, they're not going to allow that. And I don't mean, I'm not belittling what you're saying, but the court was very clear in distinguishing when you have something specific, these black individuals, bring it out at trial. Tell the jurors how incompetent the police investigation was.
Was it all dealt with regards to the HRE 412 hearing, or was there a separate hearing with regards to these other potential suspects?
No, there wasn't a hearing with respect to those.
There was an HRE 412 motion.
That was for the sexual part.
Right. But so with regards to the individual suspects, was this dealt with regards to a separate hearing or a separate set of motions?
I don't want to say it was a separate set of motions, but particularized discussions on those, yes, there was that. And that's where the court said, no, you will be allowed to do that, because that was for the purpose of attacking the police investigation and showing that they were either a rush to justice or presumptively were identifying the wrong person, and then just so dogmatic, we are not going to vary from that. We want everything to just collate with this to justify the results. So the juries had that, and they had that concept, including Kevin Luca, the husband. They were allowed to argue the husband had the motive. He was the one that killed her. So anytime there was a specific other individual with that they showed had motive and opportunity, sure, you want to argue that the husband killed her because she went out to nightclubs and he was upset because she was getting divorced and it wasn't conducive to an Air Force officer's lifestyle, have at it. And they did. And they failed, and the jury rejected it, and we're here today. Unless there's any further questions, I have nothing further for the court.
Was there any, was the pants that was found on the victim put in evidence?
Yes, they were in evidence.
Was there any evidence with respect to whether those pants fit the defendant's wife?
She said she wore a size 10. The pants were a size 10. So I'll answer it in that sense. What she said is, I don't have that brand of pants, but there wasn't a serious contention that the pants didn't fit her when she was 7 months pregnant. No.
I think one of the arguments raised is the height differential. Was that height differential between the victim and the defendant's wife? Was that explored at trial?
Explored in what sense? Like when they're on cross-examination?
In terms of the pants.
Yeah, but in what sense? Like that they interrogated the police officers. Isn't it a fact that the pants are longer than the victim's wife's, defendant's wife's legs are long? Or an argument, did they argue?
It's not her pants.
Yeah, they tried to argue it's not her pants. They definitely argued it's not her pants. They definitely relied on Nancy Griffin's testimony. I did not wear those type of pants. So the jurors heard that contention too, had the duty to determine credibility, rejected it. But I don't think that oversized pants was as significant as Darnell Griffin's wife's attempt to give him that alibi and those missing panties and that DNA. Because it sure seems logical that if I'm the rapist and I deposited my DNA in her and it leaked out into those panties so I can conceal my identity in connection to this crime, I need to get that DNA. So I get it by taking those panties. I think I did it well. If I redress her in a manner that when the police come upon her, they wouldn't instantly think rape, then they might not even think to do a vaginal swab, and I might have gotten away with this. Didn't work out that way. They took the vaginal swab, they got the DNA, they connected to Darnell Griffin. His wife couldn't disconnect him. The jury saw that, and they connected him with the guilt. Thank you.
I thought I was going to run. I have too much time, but I think I'm running out of time here. Real quick points. The evidence, the sufficiency of the evidence. Mr. Fudo points out that an ordinary person wouldn't be relieved that it was a pathfinder. An ordinary person wouldn't say, clean the car, or what. The trial record obviously is missing something that we precluded in our motion in limine. Which a PSA, Mr. Griffin is not an ordinary person when he was charged and going to trial here. Mr. Griffin was a convicted murderer. I mean, he had a murder conviction, and he's on lifetime parole. He's getting arrested. You can start speculating, clean the car. I don't want any profile. You know, there's all sorts of things that could go through. Crime Stoppers, I'm on parole. I'm going to be. His reaction is going to be different from my reaction, or let's just say any person that fits his general description who has no murder conviction would probably react differently than he would. I mean, he basically is on parole for murder. And then, so sure, his reactions for an ordinary person may be, unusual, but for him, it's almost expected. And unfortunately, that the jury couldn't, we didn't want to disclose the fact that he was on parole for murder. Clean the car, and I know, and this is being the appellate counsel and doing appellate work, and the last thing I do is, I cringe when I have to raise plain error. And I know that statement wasn't objected to, or that series of questioning, but basically, Mr. Fudo's answering brief relies on that guilt of consciousness, clean the car, even though we know that car was already on Maui, so you can't clean that car. But that evidence should never have gone in.
Did the state argue that the statement was proof of consciousness of guilt, or
trying to hide
something from the car, or try to mix the jury up that was the car that was seen driven, that was the car the defendant owned back in 1999?
No, Mr. Takata never insinuated or never stated that car was in was no longer in Mr. Griffin's possession. I mean, it's clear, the evidence is clear that car was already on Maui, sold. But it does, and without even arguing it, though, it was brought up for the reason why it was brought up for was consciousness of guilt, as well as the Crime Stoppers' reaction, so to speak. Now, real quick, the the Pathfinder. Mr. Fudo says, you know, was mistaken. The valet was mistaken, and probably, you know, he probably parks 100 cars a night, and he got interviewed the next day. So that night before, yes, he probably did park hundreds of cars, but you got to imagine he only, you know, hit one, you know, ran into the wall just with one car. I mean, there's no mistake about that. As a professional valet person, it's like, I mean, if this happens hundreds of times, I'm a little worried next time I valet my car. I don't think it does. I think it's parked. He knows it because this is an unusual event. Now, going to the standard, and I know there is no set standard, and I don't think I presented a standard that's acceptable to me, but the highest standard, I mean, Jiao, when it first started, was a pretty easy standard for the defense. And over it, it evolved into a very difficult standard. That standard is pretty difficult. I mean, I know the prosecutor, independent grand jury is different bodies, but that standard is a pretty high standard. And if that standard is applied for grand jury counsel, that's a pretty high bar. And I think if you have that standard, it'll prevent grand jury counsels from saying, oh, you know what, waste my time, he's guilty, you know. Or remarks like this. I think if we apply this to the high standard, the remarks were so extreme, Frank, and it did prejudice the defendant here in this case. One last thing, and I know that I think the statute here, and I'm just running out of time here. But I marked it down here. But just want to leave with one statement. I guess 61257 of the Hawaii Revised Statute basically says, the grand jury counsel's function shall be only to receive inquiries in matters of law by the grand jury, conduct legal research, and provide appropriate answers of law. Here it wasn't done. And then it was done so badly that it did cause prejudice. And well, the fact is that, and then sum it up, I mean, look at all the evidence. I mean, let's give the state everything. There's no evidence that caused the death. And I know I don't have that much time left, and I'll just submit on the briefs on issues 2 and 3 at this point. So if there's any other questions, I again appreciate this 30 minutes here.
Questions? Thank you very much. We'll take this case under advisement.